Again, NPR's Trina Williams takes a look at the numbers.
The last piece of the puzzle is you.
Saw 3D was the top draw at the box office. It's the seventh and supposedly final entry in the horror series and opened with an estimated $24.2 million. That's not as stellar as some of the earlier features in the franchise, but good enough to beat the weekend competition. Moviegoers also were keen on Paranormal Activity 2. It was down a spot to second place. Red held steady at number three, while Jackass 3D fell to fourth and Hereafter slipped to fifth place. Overall, the box office continued to struggle. Hollywood.com finds ticket sales down about 3% compared to last year. Trina Williams, NPR News.
Dow's up 50 at last check at 11,169. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections and celebrating National Adoption Month at AECF.org.
On the next Fresh Air.
I've been over this 100 times about my anger at my father for walking out and my mother's suicide when I was 17. My need to save people as a result.
Gabriel Byrne is back for a third season of HBO's In Treatment with new patients and a new therapist. We talk with writers Dan Futterman and Anya Epstein. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Extraordinary Voices on Friday, November 5th at 7:30 p.m. in the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Baritone Ricardo Herrera joins Sinfonia in the celebration of the works of William Schumann. More information is available at 333-6280.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls. In this part of the show, we'll be exploring some of the pop music of Russia, and our guest is Artemy Troitsky. He's a man who has been called Russia's best-known cultural journalist and also Russia's first rock DJ. He's a graduate of Moscow State University, has a Ph.D. in sociology of music from there. Started writing as part of the underground rock commentary that was circulating around Russia around the time that Western pop music really started to come in, particularly music like the Beatles and the British Invasion. And then he went on and wrote for some of the Soviet Union's most important and influential music papers. He's the author of 6 books, translated and published all over the world. One you might look at if you're interested in the subject of pop music in Russia is Back in the USSR, The True Story of Rock in Russia. He's currently someone who often comments on culture on Russian TV and radio. He is visiting professor at both Moscow State University and Russia's National University of Management. And he's here visiting the campus to give a talk about the history of Russian rock and roll. It's sponsored by the folks at the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. And he will be speaking today, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, in room 100 of Gregory Hall on the campus, and anyone who is interested in hearing his talk should feel welcome to stop by. Here on the program, too, questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Also, you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David, for inviting me here. I also am a radio DJ, so this whole environment is very familiar to me.
Maybe I'll just step out and let you take over. And we have some music, a little bit of music that at some point maybe we can play to give people a little bit of a sense of some of the music that we're talking about. So I'm really glad that you can be here.
Okay, well, if we start with music, then maybe we'll play track one from the compilation that you've brought along, because it will give the listeners some idea of what traditional Soviet pop music sounds like.
Okay, and what's the name of the performers here?
Well, it's a modern pop band called Lyube, which are especially famous for being prime minister and formerly President Vladimir Putin's favorite pop group.
All right. Mr. Putin's favorite pop group. Here we go.
Yes. взрослели, полетели Денщики окраин городских. Что им грозы, что метели, вы не судите строго их, вы не судите строго птенцов окраин городских. Пускай летят высоко орлята, учатся летать.
Do we have to play the whole track, or we can?
We can pull that out. Just we wanted to get people to feel. And it, the thing is, when I, you know, when I first heard that, I thought.
Then ZZ, you decide when.
I thought ZZ Top. Yeah. maybe this guy doesn't quite have the panache of Billy Gibbons, but you know, sort of in that territory. So tell us a little bit about this band or about this tune.
Okay. Yes. Well, this is the ZZ Top side of Russian
pop
music.
The ZZ Top of Russia. Yeah.
Well, actually, I wasn't familiar with this particular track. It does sound a bit rocky, but still, you know, this is a band called Lube, who pretend to be ex-policemen, you know, a little bit in the manner of village people, if you remember.
Oh,
you know,
oh,
they
sure.
used to
so
wear
they
policemen's wear uniforms and indigenous Indians masks and so on. So these guys are all pretending to be ex-policemen and sing, you know, brutal songs for ex-KGB members like Mr. Putin.
Mr. Putin.
But usually they're a bit softer than this particular track.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me that I would think that if you go back and you would have asked past leaders of the Soviet Union, do you have a favorite rock group? I don't know at what point you would have actually gotten some kind of response. Maybe that says that there's a great deal of difference between the official attitude toward this kind of music now and what would have been the attitude any time before Mikhail Gorbachev.
Yes, well, even Mikhail Gorbachev is not a fan of rock music. Mm-hmm. I know him personally quite well, and I think that music is one of the few issues that we never discuss with him, because I know that we're very different tastes in music. Yeah. He likes traditional Russian folk songs and, you know, kind of sing-along drinking songs. These he enjoys especially much. But before Gorbachev, of course, the communist leaders... it's not that they only didn't like rock music. They also tried to, you know, to fight it, because rock music was totally outside of the official Soviet cultural doctrine. It was considered, of course, Western, mm-hmm. because actually it was Western, decadent, ideologically harmful, and generally speaking, not worth listening to. At any age.
One of the things that I know you've talked about, and I'm sure that you're interested in, is how it is that that pop music, Western pop music, I'm sure that it was enthusiastically embraced by Russians, just like I'm sure it's been enthusiastically embraced a lot of other places. But that then Russian young people started to try to play that music. But that when they did that, and then when they went on to making their own music, there was something about it that was distinctly Russian.
Well, it's a serious question, of course. And, well, I think that rock and roll music started to infiltrate in the Soviet Union back at the end of the 50s. In 1957, we've had the Youth Festival, the Youth and Students Festival in Moscow, and this was the first time when thousands, if not tens of thousands, of young foreigners invaded the Moscow capital, at that time very sleepy, very isolated from the outside world and so on, and this was like a historical event. This was when young Russians first saw how rock and roll is danced and what actually is like blue jeans and so on. But the original American 50s rock and roll didn't really made much impact on Russian listeners. Mm. My theory says that it's simply because it was too unusual. Mm. You know, we in Europe, we like music that is melodic, a bit schmaltzy, sentimental, you know, nice to sing along to and so on. And this is especially true with Slavic people and Russian people. So if of course you cannot imagine, you know, how you can sing along, say, with Little Richard's Tutti Frutti or, you know, this kind of songs. So the American 50s rock and roll didn't became, you know, a significant thing. But when there came the Beatles, everything has changed because, you know, one of the Beatles' big achievements is that they've managed to combine and combine in a very organic way the American electric, funky, sexy rock and roll music mm-hmm. with the European melodic tradition. So this was, you know, what our kids immediately loved, and it was in the mid-60s when we've started to have first Russian rock bands, most of which, by the way, were formed by students, also by foreign students, like from the Eastern Bloc countries and from the Third World countries who've been studying in the Soviet Union at that time. And, of course, the very first, the prehistoric generation of Soviet rock bands, they only played cover versions of Western songs by the Beatles, the Beach Boys, the Rolling Stones, and later by Jimi Hendrix, you know, the Doors, and so on. So they were all like tribute bands, and you know, their biggest goal was to play these songs as close to the original as possible. Then we've started to have first rock bands who wrote their own material and dared to sing in Russian only in the beginning of the 70s. And the very first and most significant band of this generation was a band from Moscow, formed, by the way, by the students of the Moscow College of Architecture, a band called Mashina Vremeni, a time machine, led by a singer-songwriter named Andrei Makarevich. And here we have one track by Mashina Vremeni. Of course, it's not from 1972. It's much much later. I think it's track from the late 80s or early 90s. A song called "Stars Don't Take Metro."
Okay. So and which cut is that?
And this is track number 5.
Track number 5. Okay. Now I can cue up track number 5. This is Time Machine.
And we can stop anything.
Sure. So this is Time Machine, a band that's been playing, essentially the same guys now, have been all these decades, have been still playing.
Yeah, yes. This is quite an extraordinary story. The band exists from the late 60s up until now, and it's still quite popular and successful. So I think that along with, say, the Rolling Stones, they're maybe one of the very few rock bands that managed to survive since the 60s. And this song was actually very typical for Russian rock music. I mean, it's not, it's not really funky and you cannot dance to it. It's very moody. Typical Russian rock music of its classical period, i.e. the 70s and the 80s, was mostly about the message, not about the musical side of it. From the point of view of music, it has always been very secondary to American and British rock music. But when it came to lyrics, then I must admit that it was very strong. I mean, Russia generally is a country with great literary tradition and great poetry and so on. So I think that in many ways, Russian rock music is very much like Bob Dylan type of rock music, which is about mean singing, lousy playing, and fantastic images in the song lyrics. And Mashina Vremeni, they've been actually, the principal architects of this type of rock music. And this is actually also the reason why Russian rock music, although there's been very strong and well-funded attempts to promote it outside of Russia at the end of the 80s, with Gorby Mania and when Soviet Union suddenly became a very chic country, in the rest of the world, but the practice has proved that Russian rock music wasn't actually compatible with Westerners. I mean, it is called rock music, but in reality, it's something that is probably closer to the singer-songwriter type of scene. Yeah.
Well, were people in Russia, did they really get excited when there were Russian groups that started to sing in Russian?
Well, of course, they were excited, but also some Russians, they've been really frightened about it, because both the music, which was electric, and this was not a common thing in official Soviet pop music, which all sounded to big symphony orchestras or jazz big bands. Well, it has all sounded like Connie Francis or Frank Sinatra in the in the 40s and the 50s. Mm-hmm. So when electric guitars started to twang and jangle, it was very unusual experience for most Russian ears. I think even more shocking was the fact that the songs were about something completely different. I mean, they weren't, of course, about building the communist society, hundreds and thousands of Soviet propaganda songs of that time. They were also not about love affairs and dancing and having fun, which of course was also a topic of many Soviet pop songs, just to make sure that people will feel good. And they were actually very typical rock songs, which told stories about being lonely, about being alienated, about being betrayed by your friends, also about drugs and alcohol and sometimes sex and so on. So they've painted a wholly different picture of youth lifestyles than the official Soviet pop dogma did.
Yeah. Let me just quickly introduce again the guest, Artemy Troitsky. He's a Russian music and pop culture journalist, very well known in Russia for writing about, speaking about culture
popular culture, but particularly about music, rock music. And he's here to give a talk. He'll be talking about the history of Russian rock and roll this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the campus in 100 Gregory Hall, sponsored by the folks at the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. So anybody who's interested can stop by. Questions welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. So something I think is kind of interesting here is that here we think about music here in the United States, and particularly if you look at music by figures like Bob Dylan, for example, as being something that was very much about social commentary, about political commentary, about protest, and that in Russia, that really wasn't the case. At least groups weren't singing about, you know, we're going to storm the barricades and take down the Russian state. They weren't doing that. But what they were singing about, these other things that are typical of rock, teenage angst and so forth, that was perhaps just as troubling to the Russian authorities as it would have been if they were singing about, you know, about political kind of revolution.
Well, David, you're absolutely right, because in a totalitarian state, you know, the state has to have total control, and this is also the control of emotions, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like in 1994, you know, and Big Brother, he wasn't only looking after the revolt or ideology. He was also looking after all kinds of human behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, they also were looking after, you know, love making and all kinds of leisure time and so on. So in the Soviet Union, of course, you know, the ideological curtain upon the country, it has to be total, no holes. And in this respect, of course, if somebody started to say that I'm not feeling good, you know, I drink alcohol and I love it and so on, you know, that was totally unacceptable by the official lifestyle dogma. We've also had some bands and some songs which were openly and well formulated protest songs saying about, say, the KGB and the communism, but they were actually very few. I think that generally speaking, Soviet youngsters were very apolitical, so they didn't want to get involved in official political and ideological system, but they also didn't want to be a part of, say, the dissident movement. You know, what they wanted is just to be totally outside of it all, and this was the main stand of Russian rock music. Although, as I told you, there's been some exceptions, and by the mid-80s and late-80s, when we've had Glasnost and Perestroika, these exceptions became more and more common.
We have a caller to talk with. One, if you put on the headphones there, you'll hear what they have to say. Somebody who in Champagne, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Where does Okudchev's music fit in there?
Say again?
Where did Okudchev's music fit in with Russian rock?
Okay. Bulat Okudchev is a fantastic Soviet Russian / Georgian poet and novelist, and also singer songwriter, who became well known in the late 50s and was one of the most popular Russian singer songwriters throughout the 60s and the 70s. And Bulat Okudchev, as well as Vladimir Vysotsky and Alexander Galich, other great Russian singer-songwriter, or bards, as we called them, then he was, you know, one of the founding fathers, maybe, not of Russian rock, but of Russian independent songwriting. And he was a big influence on people like Andrei Makarevich and Boris Grebenshchikov, you know, the real Russian rockers of the first generations. And in a way, a classic Russian rock music may be probably called as a cross between, say, the Beatles and Bulat Okudžava. I mean, lyrically speaking, the influence of Okudžava and other Russian singers, songwriters of the 50s and the 60s was huge. But musically speaking, of course, it was a wholly different story.
All right. Hope that gets to the question of the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think maybe some people be familiar with the fact that during the Soviet times, when people were trying to circulate literature that was not approved, people made copies of things and they just surreptitiously passed them around. And apparently also the same thing happened with music. That is, that was the only way that you could get Western music. Maybe somebody got their hands on an album, on a record, and then somebody made a tape. And then maybe somebody made a tape of that tape. And so what people were doing was that they were doing this surreptitious kind of taping in their basement or wherever they could do it. And then they were passing these tapes around, and that was the way that you could hear Western pop music.
Well, you're absolutely right, but this endless home taping and spreading, you know, bad quality copies on tape, this was rather the case with underground Russian rock music. We had a whole industry which was called Mag Is That. Of course, you know the word "samizdat," you know, which stands for like, you know, Solzhenitsyn's novels, Xeroxed and typed, and distributed among you know, the dissident intelligentsia. But a much bigger phenomenon was magizdat, when millions of copies of underground Russian rock recordings, most of them made in concerts, some also made in studios, were spread all over the countries. When it comes to Western music, the main thing was the so-called black market, because officially Western rock albums were not available in the Soviet Union, and they were considered contraband. But still, there's been huge illegal business of smuggling thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of Western LP vinyl albums into the country, and they've costed a lot. I mean, like in the beginning of the 70s, when I was especially active on the black market as a customer and also as a vendor, a new album by, say, Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin could cost up to 70/80 rubles, 7080. And at the same time, the average monthly wage in the Soviet Union was 150 rubles. Like my personal salary as a scientific Mladshi Nauchny Satrudnik, a junior scientific worker at the History of Arts Research Institute, has been 125 rubles. So a new album by Deep Purple or Frank Zappa would cost me more than a half of my monthly salary.
So who could afford to buy these records, even if they were available?
Well, you know, these records, they were like sacred. So of course, like I couldn't afford having lots of these records. So what I've been doing, you know, I've bought a record, and then after listening to it and taping it, I would sell it again or trade it for another record. So this is how all these was going. And then, you know, after some time, when after, you know, hundreds of plays, vinyl record got a little unhearable.
Yes.
Then, of course, you know, it could end up as a poster.
Was there some particular record or records that, when you think back to some of the first Western pop music that you heard, that still stands out in your mind, that just blew your mind when you first heard them?
Yes. Well, there's been a plenty. Well, I think in the beginning, of course, there were the Beatles, mm-hmm. who I like, and the Beach Boys, who I also liked a lot. Then I became a fan of English blue-eyed blues, you know, bands like Yardbirds, later Cream. And then I totally fell in love with American psychedelic music of the late 60s. I think Jimi Hendrix was and probably still is one of my all-time favorites. And acts like Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band. The Doors on the mm-hmm. on a softer side. A lot of music of that era, you know, still sound fantastic to me. Although being a radio DJ, I constantly listen to all kinds of new music because I have a weekly 60 minutes long radio show in Moscow, and I dedicate this show to all kinds of music that is normally not played on Russian radio. The non-mainstream, non-chart music, be it alternative rock, electronic music, folk music, you know, all kinds of interesting things that are happening in the pop music world, but normally don't get on the commercial radio.
Yeah. You've said, I think I saw a talk that you gave, you said that Russians are not particularly funky people. And that music, particularly music that was maybe sort of aggressive or intensely rhythmic, like, oh, let's say Jerry Lee Lewis, that kind of music that was coming out of the America in the 50s, maybe didn't quite grab people as much as, say, when the Beatles came along. And that's interesting because I guess I never would have thought of the Beatles as particularly European, but maybe they are. And to Russian ears, that was a little... somehow sounded more familiar. But the other kinds of music that you're talking about really is intense and aggressive. The music that you said that, you know, really grabbed you, and maybe once we get past the Beach Boys and you get into some of that other kind of music, when was it you think that you were hearing in the music that grabbed you so much?
Well, I think I'll have to go back again to the 60s. Mm. Well, I don't think I was a typical listener because, you know, from the very beginning I've started to have, you know, some kind of professional approach to it. Like I wrote my first rock criticism back in 1967 when I was 12 years old, and I wrote a review of Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in the school newspaper. So I've been following music press and music radio shows and so on. So for me, it was really important to pick up all the new things that are happening in music, and the more original, the more outrageous they were, you know, the better I liked them. You know, I've had this maybe not a very typical attitude towards music. So, like, for instance, when in the beginning of the 70s, I first heard some German electronic psychedelic bands, you know, like Cannon, Kraftwerk, mm-hmm, Tangerine mm-hmm, Dream, and so mm-hmm, on, which played all kinds of what was called then space rock music or kosmische rock music or something. You know, I liked that a lot simply because it was something completely different from all other types of rock or pop music. You know, they didn't even add drums and guitars. So... I think my individual perception of music is seeking for innovation, and therefore I'm not very happy and satisfied with the music of the past decade in which I couldn't find much of this innovation, of this novelty.
All right. We have some other callers here. When, again, put your headset on here. We'll talk with somebody in Indiana, neighboring state, on our line four. Hello.
Hello. Hello. I'm sure glad you've done this one, Mr. Hans, because this one just sort of blows my mind. Thinking about a Russian talking about cream and blind faith, it's already exhilarated the imagination quite a bit. So I'd like to ask your guest if among this rock and roll, whether or not jazz had any play in this, and I'm particularly thinking about Miles Davis in the beginning of fusion music, whether or not that had any influence inside the Soviet Union at that time. And really appreciate you coming here and doing what you're doing, man. I must say, it's nice to know that these things are going on in other places. Blind faith and cream is too much for me, man.
All right.
Okay, thanks a lot. Well, I really appreciate it. Talking about jazz, well, jazz went in approximately the same way as rock music in the Soviet Union, but one or two decades earlier. It was totally unaccepted in the 40s and the beginning of the 50s. And at that time there was even a popular proverb saying that there's one step from a saxophone to a machine gun. Meaning that jazz is some kind of terrorist music. But jazz became fully accepted in the Soviet Union in the 60s because, well, among other things, jazz was instrumental music. So there was no verbal message in jazz, nothing that singers, songwriters, or rock musicians, you know, could do with their protest-orientated lyrics. Miles Davis in particular, well, first of all, he is my all-time favorite jazz musician. I really adore Miles Davis. He was quite big in Russia, very popular from the late 50s, you know, Shades of Blue and all those albums. And his rock fusion period of Bitches Brew and these kind of albums also became very influential. At that time, we've started to have a lot of jazz rock bands. Probably most popular of them was a band called Arsenal, led by an alto saxophone player named Alexei Kozlov. And, of course, you know, all those jazz rock bands, they've played a rather strange mixture of musics, varying from electrified jazz music and up to some songs and or arias from Jesus Christ Superstar rock opera, well, I'm sure that Miles Davis was also among the jazz tunes covered by all those numerous Russian jazz rock bands of the 70s. Then I think that by the end of the 70s, the whole jazz scene in Russia and the Soviet Union has somewhat faded because a lot of musicians have emigrated from the country and many of them now live in the United States, occasionally visiting their homeland. But I wouldn't say that Russian jazz at the moment is a scene to write home about.
Our guest in this part of Focus, Artemy Troitsky, he's a Russian music and pop culture journalist. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be talking about the history of Russian rock and roll this afternoon at 4 on the campus in 100 Gregory Hall. So if you're interested, you can stop by. And questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, can you, if you're a Russian rock band playing original music, singing in Russian, can you make good money doing that? Are there musicians that are making significant livings as musicians?
Well, indeed, it is possible to make enough money for a living if you are a popular rock musician, because The concert circuit in Russia is quite well developed. There's plenty of big clubs where rock bands play. The most popular of them play in sports arenas, and I particularly would recommend smaller clubs, and we have plenty of them. I think in Moscow alone there's maybe 20 or 30 or even more of music clubs which have live performances almost every day. And such clubs also exist in smaller cities. I think that actually the practicing of rock music in nowadays Russia is not utterly different from what you have here in America. Big bands play in stadiums, medium-sized bands play in smaller theaters, and up-and-coming underground bands play in small clubs. Mm-hmm. And of course, those young bands, they also have to have daytime jobs apart from playing music late at night.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, certainly as you know, that really changed the music business is the internet. Dramatically changed how music was promoted, distributed, gave people the opportunity to trade music back and forth. Some people have found ways to make money selling music over the internet. And many bands, I think, have found it possible for them to distribute their music that way. They don't have to deal with a big record company. You know, the technology is pretty easy. So now the workers control the means of production when it comes to music. Russian bands doing that same thing?
Well, generally speaking, I think it's a fantastic development, and I think it's a very just thing. Of course, it has more or less scrapped everything that was developing in the 20th century. You know, all those go-between institutions between the creator of the music and the listener of the music. You know, record labels, distributors, producers, blah blah. In a way, Russia was better prepared for this new musical order than the Western countries, because a record industry in both the Soviet Union and modern Russia has never been strong. In the Soviet Union, rock music was barely released on record at all, because it was wrong music. And like back in the 90s, when we've started to have the independent market-orientated record industry, it was never big. Russia has always been the country for A, live music, B, home taping. And of course, this is actually the case with the music internet situation right now. Simply, instead of home taping, you have internet downloading. And in Russia, I think that 99% of downloading is done for free, and most of the so-called pirate music websites have Russian origins and are also frequently used by internet users from America and other countries. Yes. And live music has always been strong, and I think that here again Russia is not much different from the USA.
We have about 5 minutes left. I don't know if there's anything else on this list that we have that you think you might be interesting to play.
Okay, yes. I would like to play actually a song by a Ukrainian reggae band called Pyatnitsa, Five Nitsa. And it's a song called The Soldier, and this is the only example of a protest song among those tracks that that you've brought here.
Okay.
It's a song about, you know, about a soldier and an ugly child of the war.
All right, let's hear it. Oh, as a... cut
it's
five?
Track number six.
Oh, no, no, six. Okay.
Yeah, this is track number
sorry,
six.
Sorry, Kyle. Track six.
I'm sorry for not telling you about
all right.
this.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. Я солдат.
Я не спал пять лет, и у меня под глазами мешки.
Я сам не видел,
но мне так сказали.
Я солдат.
И у меня нет башки, мне отбили ее сапогами. Йо-йо-йо, комбат орет. Разорванный рот у комбата, потому что граната белая вата, красная вата не лечит солдата.
Я солдат,
недоношенный ребенок войны.
Я солдат,
мама залечит мои раны.
Я солдат,
солдат забытой богом страны.
Я герой.
Скажите мне, какого романа?
A little bit of a Sting thing going there, I think. Anything else you want to say about that, the band or about the cut?
Well, the band doesn't exist anymore, but this was a very popular song about 5, 6, 7 years ago. And it's a very good song because, you know, like America, Russia is always at war with somebody, and soldiers unfortunately keep dying in our countries. And I think that, you know, it really is very important that artists, you know, the people, you know, who can influence other people's minds, that they say something honest about this whole military issue.
Yeah. Hip-hop is everywhere in the world. I assume that you have people in Russia doing rap music?
Yes, we do have rappers, hip-hoppers, and I think that this is probably the most happening part of the Russian pop scene right now. And also, I think that, in a way, hip-hop was a godsend for Russia because, as I tell you before, Russia is a country with great poetic traditions. And musically speaking, Russian pop and rock music has never been especially convincing. So in this context, hip-hop becomes, you know, a very good thing because there's relatively little music and no melody in hip-hop, but you can say a lot.
Yeah, the lyric is everything.
To hip-hop rhythms. Yeah. And many of Russia's most outspoken and sharp pop personalities are rappers, and I particularly would recommend a guy named or nicknamed Noise MC, who is arguably the number one Russian rapper right now. Is like Russian Eminem or or something. And you know, I really like this guy because you know, he doesn't waste time on singing about how great he is and how many, you know, cars he has and how many beautiful girls around him. He sings songs, well, he sings or he raps songs with very, very updated and sharp social and political comment. Mm. And these things are happening on a bigger and bigger scale in Russia. And generally speaking, I really like, you know, the kind of state Russian pop and especially rock and rap scene are in now.
Yeah. That was, it gets at the question I was thinking about, and that is that, you know, once, what happens when you go from something that's an underground form to something that is more legitimate and acceptable? So does it lose energy when it's not forbidden anymore?
Well, of course, it's a very difficult psychological situation, and this is exactly what has happened to Russian rock music in the beginning of the 90s. You know, it has been inspired, you know, throughout the 70s and the 80s, has been inspired, you know, by protest, by fighting back the stupidity and brutality of the Soviet totalitarian system. But then suddenly they became, you know, the system, they became the big stars, they became the money gainers, and of course this is something that I think is called identity crisis, and something and this identity crisis was very strongly visible in Russia in the 90s, when a lot of rock bands have disbanded, some prominent rock figures emigrated to the West, some even committed suicide. But right now I think we have a situation which is more or less stable, because, you know, rock has simply taken its place in this whole pop music and music industry field, and it's not especially big, but it's not small. And the political situation in Russia, of course, now gives a lot of cause for protest, because I'm afraid that Russian political leaders at the moment, they are repeating a lot of what was going on back in the Soviet times. Russia is still a country of very doubtful democracy, and although in the cultural field this is not as evident, but if we talk about our political system, then we are in many ways back to the old Soviet Union.
Yeah. Just real quick, have there been any Russian performers that have left and found success outside of Russia?
Well, I think there are some Russian expats who have never been any known in Russia, and who's emigrated to the West as children, and are enjoying quite a success now in America and Western Europe. And I think that probably the two best examples are Regina Spektor, a singer-songwriter from New York, and Gogol Bordello, a group from New York.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, around the campus, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Artemy Troitsky, he will be talking about the history of Russian rock and roll on the campus at 100 Gregg Hall. That's on Wright Street, and that's sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center this afternoon, 4 o'clock. And he is himself visiting professor at Moscow State University, and Russia's National University of Management is often heard and read in Russia, commenting on pop culture and music. And if you're interested in reading on the subject, you might take a look at his book, Back in the USSR, The True Story of Rock in Russia. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. All the best.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at mckinley-church.org. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. 1 minute before noon, 49 degrees in Urbana. Let's take a look at commodity prices and how the contracts are faring in Kansas City and in Chicago on this Monday morning, late Monday morning. December wheat in Kansas City, 761 and three quarters, down 9 and a quarter. March, 775, down 11 and three quarters. Chicago Chicago, December, wheat 705 and three quarters, down 11 and a half. March, 748, down 9 1/4. December corn, 580, down 2. March, 590 and three quarters, down 4 1/4. May, 599, down 2. July, 601 and three quarters, down 2. November soybeans, 1225 and a half. That's down 1/2. January, 1235 and a quarter, down 3/4. March, 1239 and a half, down 3/4. May, 1239 and 3/4. It looks like that is not trading, that contract. December meal, 336.10, down 160. December oil, 49.72, up 42. December live.